Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On our program today, how portions of the Sierra foothills are being preserved, not only to protect the wildlife, but for future generations to enjoy. We invite you to take a hike with us. And a conversation with the U.S. Supreme Court justice whose legal views could have a huge impact on Proposition 8. And how the death of an elderly Bakersfield woman at a senior living center is sparking a conversation we all need to have with our loved ones. But first, on our program, and it's such a lovely day to bring you this program, this particular story as well. With spring in the air and flowers budding across the region, a local conservation group is working to preserve the beauty of the valley's foothill ranch land. The Sierra Foothill Conservancy invited the public to explore one of its more popular wildlife preserves this past weekend. 89.3's Ezra Romero visited the open house and brings you this report.
On the edge of a region in California known for agriculture and dairy lays a hidden gem, a wildlife preserve with tabletop foothills that in spring are awash in color from budding wildflowers. On Saturday, the Sierra Foothill Conservancy, a local group that manages a number of foothill preserves in the region, held a special open house at the group's largest operation. The Mackenzie Preserve, in between Fryin and Prather, was open to the public for exploring, and a hike up a flat-top, lava-formed table in the region.
Good morning! Hi! Want to please sign in before you start up the hill?
That was Bea Olson, the board president for the Sierra Foothill Conservancy. A couple hundred people followed a well-worn 3.5-mile path to the base of a tabletop, and then hiked up the steep face of the hill before they reached the top of the plateau.
We're out here just opening up the property to get people connected to Foothill Woodlands and these beautiful lands here in the Sierra Nevada.
That was Rodney Olson, board member for the Sierra Foothill Conservancy. On top of the hill, the view is endless, almost as if the valley floor rose 1,000 feet. Olson, who is also a biologist, says the reason the tables exist is because of lava.
The story goes, we have a lava flow, which flowed down the ancestral San Joaquin River. And as it flowed down, it capped in the riverbed. And over time, and we think this is probably between 9 and 10 million years, we had an erosion of the surrounding countryside rock. And so you get this inverted topography where what was once a river channel or a river bottom is now up at the top of the hill.
Visitors couldn't have picked a more beautiful day to explore the preserve.
We're trying to figure out what the heck we're looking at here. So we haven't found the wildlife expert wildflower expert we're looking for. So we're up here looking at the at this little red kind of a succulent, almost like a succulent, and the little lupins that are coming up out here.
That's Steve Beck and Pamela Jurgens. They traveled from Southern California to visit the preserve on the advice of family.
Very impressive. I was not expecting this. It was a little hike for my legs, but up at the top, the views are really nice. The wildflowers are just starting to come out. You can see some blankets of yellow and the lupin. Yeah, we don't have lupin in Southern California.
Mike Stafford had wanted to climb the hill since he was a child. Sunday was his lucky day.
It wasn't that bad of a walk up. I had friends would come up here. I never came up here myself. It was always, oh, we went to the tabletop today. How come you didn't go with us, you know? So, but the climb was good. I like how they identified stuff.
The only gripe besides the sudden incline visitors mentioned was that the preserve isn't often open to the public.
I wish they would have a season of maybe 2 weekends in a row per month or 2 days in a row, so that you could come up in March, April, May, and then close it off when it gets dry maybe and start again for a couple of months in November.
That was Cindy Laurenti, who lives near the preserve. But despite minor complaints, the visitors hiked up and down the hill successfully.
I'd say it's pretty much a gem. I don't know how hidden it is, but it's pretty nice. If I lived up here, I would be up here as much as you could be.
The Conservancy also holds special classes and 2 more special public days this season.
people may think they may not be able to make it. I mean, darn, I'm 61, I can make it. This one keeps complaining about, you're too slow. But, you know, if you take your time, you can get here. And it's beautiful. It's well worth the walk up.
For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero.
Now, if that doesn't want to make you take a hike, I don't know what would. You can go to Valley Public Radio, our website at kvpr.org, for more information on the McKenzie Preserve and to find out about future events and hikes. Now, joining us now to talk more about the Sierra Foothill Conservancy is Jeanette Tuitelli-Lewis. She's the executive director at Sierra Foothill Conservancy. First of all, just at listening to that story, it was, you know, it was absolutely beautiful. You could sort of get a vision of or a picture of what it is he was talking about. But tell us, first of all, just a little bit about the Sierra Foothill Conservancy and the lands that you have preserved thus far.
Sure. Sierra Foothill Conservancy started in about 1996, so we've been around for a while. We started out with accepting two major properties, one of them being the McKenzie Preserve and another one being on Black Mountain. We began our work by using those two properties as a place to expand our conservation work. So currently we have 8 properties that we own in fee title, and then in addition to that, we also partner with ranchers to do conservation easements.
Wow, that sounds... And it's all in the Sierra Foothills, this property, this land?
Yeah, we work between Yosemite Kings Canyon National Parks in the foothills and a little bit up into the forest as well. So most of our properties are in Fresno, Madera, Mariposa counties, and then we have one in eastern Merced.
What kind of goes into choosing the properties that you choose to preserve?
So we have a land committee, and we have a list of criteria that the land committee reviews when we're selecting properties. So a lot of it has to do with location, size, the resources that are on the property, if it has special threatened or endangered species. They tend to have a higher priority than those that have common species. But the other thing is we also want to make sure that we're keeping common species common. And so we also, of course, consider that and factor that into any of our decision making. So,
no, you talked about the different lands or the different preserves. Some of them you can hike, others not.
That's right. So some of them are much more remote, and, of course, we always have to be concerned about liability on our properties, and we try to make the ones that are close enough to the sort of urban centers available and those that we can keep sort of a closer eye on. So,
Did you recently acquire another piece of property?
That's right. Our most recent acquisition is what is now known as the Ted Martin Wildlife Preserve. And this was completed in December of this past year. It's a beautiful 280-acre property with 4 ponds and incredible wildlife. And that property has a higher donor restrictions on that. So that one isn't going to be open to the public all the time, but it'll be used for special meetings and that sort of thing.
So most of these lands, they're open to the public?
Well, 4 out of 8 of our properties are, and of course our conservation easements are owned by private landowners, so we don't have those rights to be able to open them up. We're just a partner for the landowner.
Okay. You've also, we found that the conservancy, you own land, that's the Sierra Lands Beef Company, that's part of it as well. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so a couple years ago, we had decided to form an LLC, which is called Sierra Lands Beef. So it is owned solely by the Conservancy, but it is separate. Everything is separate. Our finances are separate, and of course, it's a for-profit entity as opposed to a nonprofit entity. And we had decided for a few reasons to form it, one being that it gives us a little bit more control over the grazing management and allows us to try some more sort of experimental things to see if we can increase biodiversity on our properties. Secondly, it's a way to provide some unrestricted revenue that can go back into helping us manage all of our properties and lands. And thirdly, we thought, you know, if this grows and it really takes off, we can really develop this larger co-op, bring other small family producers sort of into the program, and that would that would actually help to keep range land in family ranching operations. And so it's also a way to sort of help meet our mission for preserving sort of the best ranch lands.
And also, there really is more people are learning more about grass-fed beef, and that's what you're able to produce there.
That's right. It's direct marketing, and you know, it seems that there's a lot of room to grow in the market. I mean, it's interesting. You know, it has become a very sort of robust trend.
So. yes, it has, and that's why I'm thinking, what a great kind of business model that you developed. You developed something that not only really takes care of the land, but is also quite marketable to people.
That's right. So it's exciting for us.
Now, tell us about some of the hiking events and some of the hiking tours. How often and which lands are we talking about?
So on four of our properties, we offer hikes and classes. Our hike and class season begins in the fall, and it goes all the way through the spring. Most people don't really want to be out there in the summer when it's scorching hot.
No, so, a day like today would be great, though.
Yes. And so we have a committee that, you know, decides on all the various classes that we're going to offer. Some of the exciting ones that are coming up is that we have this weekend we have a Yoga Under the Oaks class. So we have a variety of different classes that we offer. There's also a open house on our Feingold Creek property. That's this Sunday, I believe. And then we have a geocaching class coming up in a couple weeks and another open house on the Mackenzie. I know that it was mentioned in the recorded portion of the program that there is, I know that lots of folks do wish that we were able to open our properties more than we're able to. We're not a park and we don't really have the resources of that. But we did this year really make an effort to open it up more to the public. Last year and in previous years, we've had one weekend where it was an open house. And this year, the board got together and decided, you know, there really is a need to be able to connect these lands to people. They want to be out there. Let's see, you know, let's try it out. Let's open up the preserve once a month from January to April, see if we get interest and, you know, see how it goes and get volunteers to help with the, you know, with organizing it. And so that's what we've been doing. And every event has been a success. So I think that the board is probably going to decide that we need to at least keep it and perhaps expand it next
year.
And
I thought it was really interesting that you had people coming from Southern California. Somehow they had learned about this as well.
Yeah. Well, I think we've got members all over the state. So, of course, most of our members are local, but I think that the Sierra Foothills are a very special and unique place, and they attract all kinds of people from across the state. So,
now, you mentioned a number of events coming up. Where can people get information about this?
So the easiest way is to go to our website at www.sierrafoothill.org and click on our hikes and classes events, and And you can register for classes there and learn about upcoming events. So.
Also, for people who want to volunteer.
That's right. You can go to the same website, or you can contact the office and let us know. We have all sorts of volunteer opportunities, so it's really up to, you know, we have a lot of office work, of course, like any nonprofit does.
Yeah.
But most people like to get out on the property, so we always have fence building projects, and we also have some restoration work going on. So I think
there are lots of opportunities for people to get involved.
That's right.
In this, if they'd like to.
Yep.
Well, it really sounds great. I love the story with the hiking event, and it just seems like it's a nice time of year for people just to enjoy. And I don't know if people knew that they had all these lands that were being preserved that were close by. You know, you can take a drive and you'll see some of the property and you kind of wonder, you know, who owns it? Can you get out and enjoy it? And now it's really nice to know where it's all located and what people can do. Mm-hmm. And could you just give us that website one more time? I have a feeling people would like to hear that.
Sure. It's www.sierrafoothill.org.
Okay. Thank you very much. It was so nice to have you in. Jeanette Tuatelli-Lewis, Executive Director at Sierra Foothill Conservancy.
Thank you.
Well, from the effects of climate change to the threat posed by a giant asteroid, there's a lot of things that we as humans worry about. But when faced with the possibility that humans may suffer the same fate as the dinosaurs, what should our national response be? On this edition of our commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State philosophy professor Andrew Fiala points to a pessimistic conclusion.
Recent cosmic events remind us that human existence is fragile. Last month, a meteor exploded over Russia as an asteroid careened nearby. Should we be concerned about cosmic calamity, or are there more important things to fret about? The risk of damage from a medium-sized meteor strike is small. Most of the world is covered with oceans and deserts. It's unlikely that a space rock would hit a populated area. Scientists are working to monitor near-Earth objects. One team wants to crash a rocket into an asteroid in an attempt to move it. Unfortunately, if we saw a truly catastrophic asteroid headed our way, there's nothing we could do to stop it. Imagine how difficult it would be to actually hit an asteroid with a rocket and successfully push it away from Earth. In such a scenario, it would be nice to have some advance warning, but at that point, we might as well throw a doomsday party and enjoy ourselves. This points toward a significant problem for rationality and ethics. In some circumstances, it's rational to take up a shovel and get to work. But in other circumstances, it makes more sense to take up a fiddle and play. The problem is that we are not very good at assessing those circumstances and allocating our resources. We like to kid ourselves and believe that we can outsmart disaster and disease, but that's not true. The dinosaurs went extinct. We all die eventually. The trick is knowing which things to worry about and how much. We also need to know when to stop worrying and embrace the inevitable. Big and spooky risks, like doomsday rocks from space, can absorb our attention despite the fact that they are unlikely and unstoppable. Meanwhile, it's easy to ignore other, less spectacular problems. The cost of finding a way to prevent asteroid impact is immense, while the risk is small. Meanwhile, mundane diseases like malaria afflict many people living today, and malaria mitigation is relatively cheap. Let's end malaria before we worry about asteroids. We should not devote our resources to expensive and improbable solutions for unlikely existential threats when there are other more pressing concerns. And yet, extinction is forever, so we can't ignore the big threats entirely. But we do ignore serious threats. We build and rebuild cities in hurricane-stricken coastal areas, which are going to be ravaged by worse storms as the climate changes, and no one is taking serious action to prevent climate change. Perhaps the reason for this is that it is rational to pursue short-term satisfaction while ignoring speculative worries about worst-case scenarios. We play our fiddles and keep our fingers crossed, enjoying the good times while they last. This points toward a pessimistic conclusion. When ultimate disaster strikes, we will be unprepared. We're not wired to take existential threats seriously. Nor, of course, were the dinosaurs, whose dead bodies we burn in our cars every day. For The Moral Is, this is Andrew Fiala.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
He's not only from California. Justice Anthony Kennedy's U.S. Supreme Court rulings, past and future, are felt in California. He wrote the ruling in a case involving the state's overcrowded prisons, and many observers feel the fate of Proposition 8 is in his hands. He returned to his hometown of Sacramento last week for the opening of the Justice Anthony M. Kennedy Library and Learning Center at the federal courthouse. He sat down Thursday afternoon for an interview with Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief, Ben Adler.
As of last month, you passed your 25-year anniversary sitting on the bench. I wonder, as you reflect back on those 25 years, how you feel the court has changed over that time.
I'm not sure the court has changed. I think perhaps the perception of the court has changed slightly, although you would be in a better position than I to make that judgment. I don't like to see the court being judged in a political way. We decide decisions with political consequences, but we don't decide them in a political way. There are parties that claim that they're being injured, and there's a real dispute, and we're in the business of resolving real disputes. But we do so in accordance with the tradition of the common law and the tradition of the case system.
There are those who said in the aftermath of the federal health care ruling that Chief Justice Roberts wrote that he was trying to avoid being political in that ruling.
Well, I think all of us have tried to avoid political. We tried to decide the case based on the constitutional structural issues that were before us, and we disagreed, as was predicted. That's the reason we take the cases, because the lower courts are in disagreement.
Well, speaking of cases where there's a lot of disagreement, one that you authored that has a very big impact on California and is getting a lot of talk now is the one involving the prison system here in the state, which has been overcrowded, and you ruled that the overcrowding was unconstitutional, cruel and unusual punishment, and the state needed to reduce its prison population. Could you talk about why you ruled the way you did?
Well, we don't generally talk about the background of our decisions, because if we've done our job the right way, the reasons are given in the decision. People say, oh, a legal opinion is going to be dry and boring. I think high school students could and should read the prison opinion. We should know what's happening in our prisons. You know that our prison terms are 8 times longer than the prison terms in Europe that are given for equivalent crimes. And it's very, very expensive to incarcerate prisoners. Part of the problem is judges and attorneys and law students are fascinated with the guilt or innocence process. We don't think about the correctional process. I think the public thinks that the lawyers and judges run the prisons. They don't. Judges may think that social workers and psychiatrists run the prisons. I'm not sure they do either. But Winston Churchill said a society is judged by how it treats the least deserving of its people. And we have to think about that with prisons. Now, there are some very dangerous people in prison that must be confined. But we have to, I think, look very hard at our penal methodologies. I don't think it's working.
Finally, I think everyone in California and a lot of people around the nation are keeping a pretty close eye on one case that you're about to hear oral arguments on, Proposition 8, same-sex marriage. Obviously, you're not going to comment on that because it's pending. Could you talk a little bit about your judicial philosophy as it relates to individual rights?
Well, I think, again, that judicial philosophy is expressed in the opinions. We give reasons for what we do. We write them out, and they're there for all to see. And I do think it's important that the public understands the reason judges don't comment in these cases, not because we know the answer and it's a secret it's not telling, it's because it's not fair to the process. The process is that the lawyers make the arguments, the judges talk with each other, and we have an open mind. If you commit yourself to a certain philosophy or to a certain result, you're not going to have the open mind that your oath requires you to have to be a judge.
Well, Justice Kennedy, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your work. It's very important for you to cover the courts.
That was U.S. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy with our Capitol Bureau Chief, Ben Adler. They spoke Thursday afternoon before the dedication of a library and statue in his honor at the federal courthouse in downtown Sacramento.
Our next story has set off a huge debate. Just what is the responsibility of a private living facility when it comes to providing life-saving care to the elderly people who choose to live there? Is a licensed nurse obligated to perform CPR, even if the facility in which she works says that is not their policy? And when should family members have the conversation about end-of-life care? All of these questions came into focus last week when 87-year-old Lorraine Bayless, the resident at a senior living center in Bakersfield, died after a staff member refused to perform CPR on Bayless. The incident unfolding on a recorded 911 call. That call prompted outrage across the nation.
Okay, that's not. We need to get CPR started. That's not enough. Okay.
We can't do CPR.
Okay, then hand the phone. Hand the phone to the passerby. If you can't do it, I need to hand it to the passerby. I'll have her do it. Or if you've got any citizens there, I'll have them.
No.
Anybody there can do CPR. Give them the phone, please. I understand if your facility is not willing to do that, give the phone to that passerby, that stranger that had it sent. This woman's not breathing enough. She's going to die if we don't get this started. Do you understand?
I understand.
Okay.
I am a nurse, but I cannot have our other senior citizens who don't know CPR.
I will instruct them in
this. We're in a dining room.
I will instruct them. Is there anyone there who's willing?
That.
Okay. I don't understand why you're not willing to help this patient.
I am. Okay, great. Then I'll walk you
through it all. Well, some say it was the tone of the nurse's voice that upset them, combined with her refusal to perform CPR, despite the pleas from the dispatcher, the nurse citing the facility's policy as to the reason why she didn't perform CPR. Joining us for our discussion is Dr. Michael Nesko. He did his specialty training at the Harvard Center for Palliative Care, and he is now the medical director of St. Agnes Medical Center Hospice and Palliative Care and has been the chair of the Ethics Committee for the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. And joining us shortly will be Dr. Christopher Myers, director of the Kegley Institute of Ethics, professor of philosophy, CSU Bakersfield. Dr. Myers is also a member of the medical staff at Kern Medical Center, where he provides ethics consulting and education services. Dr. Nesko, thank you for joining us right now. And what I'd like to do is just to address some of the questions that have kind of lingered after this incident. Before we go into our discussion of end-of-life care, because I think that's really where this conversation is probably going now for many people after they've had a chance to really take a look at this incident and see what really happened. Now, despite the fact that the family of Lorraine Bayless doesn't fault the nurse's actions or the facility's actions at all, there has been this debate about if the nurse as a licensed medical professional, is required to perform CPR, no matter if the facility says there is a policy against it. Are nurses required in these kinds of incidents or required to take these kinds of measures no matter what?
Thank you, Juanita. Thank you for having me here. Very important issue. And regarding the nurse's obligation to treat, the nurse's obligation to treat is not as straightforward as one might think. The obligation to treat in an acute care facility, for example, where a patient is admitted or a visitor would be different from if a nurse was not on duty and on a sidewalk and at Disneyland, say. If you're not an acute facility and you see someone outside the window, is the nurse's obligation to leave the building and go out and perform CPR? Or are they even obligated to call 911? This professional practice standards actually aren't necessarily on nursing my area of expertise, but I can tell you it's not always very clear, and it's still not clear to me exactly in this situation was the patient where she actually coded. Was it in the acute side? Was it in a skilled side? What was the licensing of the building that she was in? Or was it in a common, unlicensed area? And all of these things come into play when you're talking about the nurse's legal or professional obligation. Clearly, there is another ethical perspective where you would want a nurse to, by default, try to resuscitate someone if they didn't know for certain that they didn't want to be resuscitated.
But I think, you know, you hit on a very valid point. At this point, there's still I think they're still investigating. They're going to wrap up this investigation. But it was truly the 911 call and the constant playing of that 911 call that has sort of set this whole situation off. And now I think people are taking a step back. You know, they're conducting an investigation. And even you take a look at the facility itself. It issued a statement in the beginning that now it's sort of changed, first saying that it was the facility's practice to immediately call emergency medical personnel for assistance and wait with the individual needing the care until paramedics arrived. Then they follow up saying that Glenwood Gardens was conducting an internal investigation and kind of reviewing its policies involving emergency medical care. Is there anything wrong with this? And basically, just because of the 911 call, does this really, and I'm sure you would know that, but what I'm thinking about really warning this kind of a large-scale investigation and then politicians getting involved. And
it's always... I mean, it's rarely in the patient's interest when things get blown out of proportion like this. And I do think that this is out of proportion for the situation in the sense that we don't know what really went on. We know what we've heard through various media sources. I know that there are situations similar to this that happen, you know, every day in emergency rooms. It's an important issue, nevertheless, for us to work out. But what I've been on the other side of this, on the patient side, trying to protect patients' privacies as certain important individuals that the media are interested in will get a hold of a piece of a story that will go off in the wrong direction and isn't put in the context. And when we're making these decisions, context is everything. I don't know, for example, did that nurse know this patient personally? And had she told her the week before, don't you ever do CPR on me if I fall down? Had she had this kind of information and made a commitment to that person, and you know, when the lady who actually wasn't a patient, I'm sorry, she was a resident in a living facility, an independent living facility, I believe, which mm-hmm. wasn't licensed whatsoever. Had she signed when she agreed to live there, had she signed a contract that she understood that the staff would not do CPR, and if that case, was there actually an obligation by the staff to not do CPR. Maybe that's why she chose to live there, because people won't do CPR. I mean, we just don't know the backstory at all.
But and I think that's probably part of the concern is that, like we said, the 911 call sort of set everything off, and people hadn't had a chance to really take a look at the entire situation before a lot of statements were made. Right now, I'd like to bring in Dr. Christopher Myers. He's the director of the Kegley Institute of Ethics and a professor of philosophy at CSU Bakersfield. Dr. Myers, what about all of the ethical questions kind of involved in this situation?
Good morning. Thanks for having me on. all of the ethical questions, boy. And what a place to start.
Not all of them, though.
You want to focus that?
Yeah, why don't we narrow it down to the fact of the obligation of a nurse in a particular situation, the obligation of maybe the facility. There are some people, without knowing the full story, just assume that they should be obligated, even if there's a policy, when it comes to just pure ethical reasons, should have taken steps or certain measures to save this woman, not
right.
really knowing all of the information in the background.
Yeah, I was able to hear some of Dr. Nisko's comments, and I think they were right on that context is everything. It can't be the case that a healthcare professional, nurse or otherwise, has a duty to always provide CPR in all circumstances, as the example of somebody who has a clear advance directive demanding otherwise attests. I do think that healthcare professionals have an obligation to provide some medical care or some medical comfort in any circumstance in which somebody's in distress. And as Dr. Nisko was just indicating, we really don't know enough of what happened in that dining hall on that afternoon. It could be very well be that either the nurse on the phone provided Mrs. Bayless' loving assistance or made sure others did, some kind of intervention was clearly appropriate. Whether that included CPR, I think the family's answer tells us exactly both what Ms. Bayless expected and what the family expected, which was that they should not have done that level of aggressive intervention.
And that's what the family's saying, and I've also read that that's what the resident, Mrs. Bayless, that's what she preferred as well. And then there had also been talk about the possibility, and again, all of these questions coming because people don't have all of the answers yet and haven't completed whatever investigation is ongoing, that even sometimes when you have an elderly patient at that age, you know, I think she was 86, 87, it's just not a matter of automatically saying you're going to perform CPR because of just for medical reasons for that patient because of their age.
There are any number of circumstances in which providing CPR will provide far more harm than good. And he has far more experience. I think it's
okay, Dr. Nesko, you put you on the spot there.
Yeah, you certainly did. I hate to make too many assumptions on patients based on age alone. I had a patient in the hospital a little while back who was 87, and the treating physician said to me, we found a lung tumor, and I think we should just do palliative care in hospice because she's kind of old. And I went in and talked to her, and she told me that she was really upset that she was going to not be able to take her mother out for lunch.
No, and I don't
next week.
I don't think you so, can assume anymore because of age, but it really depended upon that patient and what that patient wanted.
Absolutely.
And from what we're hearing, even though there was no documentation, what we're hearing from the family and the people at the facility is that she knew going in. She picked that particular facility to live, knowing their policies.
Knowing their policy, that's right. So age clearly is one reason why we should have these discussions and talk with our loved ones and have post forms and advance directives. I'd say it's not the only story, and I don't think that's what Dr. Myers was implying either. Other comorbidities, some folks should have these, you know, as soon as they turn 21. Mm-hmm. A lot of folks should.
I mean, there are a lot of reasons, and it's not just for age. But before we go to break, I think one of the things, too, and I don't know if either one of you, this is your area of expertise, but I think it would be helpful if we could explain the difference between, you know, an independent living facility and an assisted living facility and a skilled nursing facility, because they're all different.
Well, I can do that.
Go
that.
Right
sure.
ahead, Dr.
All right,
Nesko.
Sure. So there are many facilities in the community to take care of those who need help. There's residential care for the elderly facilities, which are sort of board and care types. There's licenses that we provide when there's a need for skilled staff. An assisted living facility doesn't have anyone there who, as a rule, although they may have people come in from time to time, that can even pass medications. There's no RNs there. It doesn't provide any kind of skilled nursing. A skilled nursing facility, on the contrary, will have a licensed nurse there 24 hours who should be usually trained in CPR. There's a patient chart with orders. They're getting some sort of skilled care, like care for tracheostomies, physical therapy, care of feeding tubes, or intravenous medications. So that would be a skilled nursing facility. As I said, the assisted living doesn't have that skilled nurses. And then there's the independent living, which is just an apartment.
And that's where she was.
Yes.
It was like apartment living for her. But I think, you know, because of this incident and the follow-up discussion, is that when families sit down and they discuss or even the residents themselves, they need to take a look and understand each of these facilities and talk to the people at the facilities about their policies and have a clear understanding if you're going to become a resident of any one of these kinds of facilities.
Oh, absolutely. Very important to make sure that you find a facility that matches the needs. There's not only different kinds, but different themes to facilities. Some like this, for example, who it sounds like made it very clear that we want to take care of folks who aren't really prepared, or we want to be able to respect the needs of those who don't want CPR if it comes time that they are dying, and if they die here in our facility.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we are going to talk about end-of-life care and how basically it really doesn't matter the age, we should all be prepared. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. A lot has been said about the patient who died at a living care facility in Bakersfield after the nurse's refusal to perform CPR. But now, as more information is coming about the story, we do understand. We're going to play just a portion of the 911 call again. But what we will learn is all of this could have been prevented had a piece of paper been signed and put in place, and why it's important for all of us to take a look at that.
If you get anybody, any stranger that happens to walk by that's willing to help, I understand if your boss is telling you you can't do it. Yeah. But if there's any, as a human being, I don't, you know, is there anybody that's willing to help this lady and not let her die?
Not at this time.
No, they won't touch her at all. I can't get them to touch her at all.
We have residents.
By now, we've all heard this 911 tape. But as time moves on, we're learning more and more about this incident. For instance, the family of Lorraine Bayless, the elderly woman who did pass away, do not fault the facility. They do not fault the nurse. They said that their loved one did not want any life-sustaining measures taken. She was aware of the facility's policies when she decided to move there. And after a week of this kind of discussion, what we hear is that the nurse and the facility and the family all could have been spared what they've had to go through if, you know, a piece of paper had been signed. Now, joining us with our discussion, we have Dr. Michael Nesko and also Dr. Christopher Myers. We're going to continue this conversation about the importance of letting your wishes be known as how you want to be cared for at the end of life. And right now we're seeing part of that, because even though the family is saying, look, this is what our loved one wanted, from what I've been able to understand, there was no directive on file. So you really do have to do more than just say it.
Absolutely, Juanita. And we have some wonderful tools here in California to help people in this exact circumstance. We have an advanced directive for healthcare with a durable power of attorney for healthcare that people can download off the internet for free. And you can complete it and appoint a legal decision maker for yourself who speaks with all of the legal authority that you speak with to make decisions for yourself. And you don't need a lawyer to sign it. You just need two witnesses. I don't even need a notary, although you can have a notary do that. And that's how we appoint someone to speak for us when we become too ill to speak for ourselves. And there are versions of that available readily online. And then there's a second document which complements that, which is equally as important, called the POLST form, the Physician Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment, which is a nationwide initiative. And the most important thing about the POLST form is it is a legal DNR order that needs to be honored anywhere in California. And this was a new paradigm once this rolled out in California. Before then, you couldn't have a DNR order while you were walking on the sidewalk because you only had orders when you were in a skilled facility. But the health department and the the legal codes in California now support that any healthcare provider should follow the directive of a post form when they see it as though it was an order. They don't have to verify the physician's license. They can follow it if it, in good faith, and in doing so, will be completely protected from any civil, criminal, or professional liabilities as long as they're following that directive in good faith.
Dr. Myers, hopefully you can answer this particular question, because when we talk about the incident in Bakersfield, you know, we all don't have all the information, or we aren't privy to what's being investigated at this point. But in a situation where you have in this situation where the family is saying, you know, look, we know that this is what she wanted, but there is no document. Could it put people at risk, those who provide or don't provide the care?
Yeah, it probably can put people at risk either way. I of course, can't speak to the legal requirements there. But so if you don't know, our social and medical standard is that you err on the side of providing intervention. Ironically, I happened to be in the facility on the day this happened, on a completely unrelated case. And I had with me Dr. Jennifer Black, who's one of our palliative care physicians in town. She asked me later, so what if I'd gone over to the dining hall to get a cup of coffee and saw Miss Bayless in distress? She felt like, not knowing otherwise, she probably would have had to do some level of intervention. As we now know, she wasn't, in fact, in cardiac arrest. She'd had a stroke and was in respiratory distress. So CPR probably would not have provided her any assistance anyway. But just reinforcing Dr. Nisko's point, both those documents, the Advanced Healthcare Directive and the Pulse, are absolutely the way to go. The problem is that sometimes they're not always available. She may have filled out a Pulse form, but it's, as we regularly recommend, magneted to her refrigerator. And if it's not immediately available, it makes it really tough for folks to try to figure out what the default should be. I don't have a Pulse form, but I do have an advanced directive. And I keep a little card in my wallet right next to my insurance card, first place to look, of course, indicating who my agents are and to call them immediately should the circumstances appropriately arise. And I think the far most important thing of all of these documents, the mantra of the Pulse movement, is it's all about the conversation. It's one thing to fill these things out. It doesn't do a whole lot of good if you haven't talked with your family about it, if you haven't talked with your loved ones, the people who are likely going to be at your side in such circumstances. Those conversations can be really hard. I've done them very badly, and fortunately, on a few occasions, I've done them well. But in the end, it gets everybody to the place where they can feel comfortable saying, that's in fact what our mother wants or our father wants, and that's in fact what we will do in those circumstances.
Dr. Nisko, what he talked about is a difficult situation that many families are facing. And so how can you approach a family member? How can you kind of get into this conversation? Because from what I've read, a new survey just released last year said that only about 23% of Californians have put their end-of-life wishes in writing. So that means the majority of us haven't, probably not, have had that conversation. So, you know, how can we bring up that conversation?
You know, it is a difficult conversation to have with someone you love. It raises emotions, and the emotions sometimes are a barrier to going forward with the conversation that needs to take place. I find, and evidence shows, that many of the older generation is very much wanting to speak with their children about it. And it's actually the children themselves who have the hard time. Oh, well, Mom, don't say that. I don't want to talk about that, Mom. But, you know, it's a gift they're trying to give their adult children, is I don't want you to be in the position to to have to decide for me and make a difficult decision. I want you to know what I want right now. And that's one of the best ways that I or most useful ways that I phrase it when I'm talking with people about how to approach their son is, I'd like to give you a gift here. I want to tell you what I want so you're not in the position of having to make a difficult decision. You're just following what I want. Take the burden on myself instead of you. Oftentimes, it's easy to have a third party in the room, even with couples who've been together for 60 years or more. I find I have a particularly hard time talking about these issues. And when you have a person who's trained in these conversations present, sometimes the conversation can be easier if you're talking with your physician, your personal physician, or nurse practitioner, or other provider. But it's an important conversation, and once you get over the initial lump in your throat, you feel much better after having had it with the people that you love.
And we talk about, this is a conversation that, many adults are having with their, parents who are now elderly, so that does make it difficult. But when it comes to end-of-life care, that anybody could be placed in that situation at any time. And so can you have that conversation, or can you decide even with your children, if this were to happen to you, God forbid, if you were in an accident and this happened, how do
excellent
you handle
question.
That?
That's an excellent question. And I think one of the points we try to make with the post form and DNR conversations or these sorts of conversations is the conversation really needs to be about values rather than specific treatments. The conversation should be, what makes life worth living to me? What kind of suffering would I not want to have under any circumstance? These kinds of conversations can help guide your decision maker. In fact, we often suggest we don't complete a post form or a DNR order unless someone's within the last year or two of life or we think that they might be, because there's so many different ways that people can die. You can have a heart attack, a stroke, and different people would want different treatments. And it's very hard to go there unless you've been there before to know exactly which treatment you would prefer. But if you are able to talk about your goals, about living independently, about being able to feed myself, being able to talk with my family and my loved ones, and at what point I wouldn't want heroic or aggressive medical measures to keep me from dying based on a certain function or other illness that I might have, then that helps guide the people you love, I find, a lot better than specific instructions about treatments or medications.
Okay.
And there are some great tools for helping to motivate that conversation. One is they're called the Go Wish cards that walk you through your values, your goals in life. And it helps you to narrow down the things that are most important to you that can help everybody understand what's most important to you and use it to help fill out some of these forms. I'll give you a quick anecdote about doing it for our younger family members. I was having the conversation with my folks, my parents, in the process of filling out forms for them. And my stepson came in the room and said, "Geez, do you think my wife and I ought to have one of these?" They were brand new parents. And I said, "Well, boy, you guys do a lot of driving. You're always tired when you're in the car. Now, God forbid you would have a car accident. But that's the circumstance in which it would be appropriate." As I was finishing that sentence, my daughter called, standing beside the freeway down by Magic Mountain, having just totaled her car in a terrible rainstorm, reinforcing just how quickly your life can change in dramatic ways and how important it is for all of us to be thinking about exactly the sorts of things that Dr. Nisko was just describing.
But as you mentioned, it truly is difficult for many people to have that kind of conversation. We mentioned earlier, too, not all of these documents, you don't need a lawyer, they don't have to be legal, is there any situation where you have to have a legal document?
There's Gerbilpoff Attorney for Finances. Maybe you have to have one there, I'm not sure. But for our health directives, for our post forms, you need well, for the advance directive appointing a decision maker, you just need, you know, two witnesses, at least one of which can't be a family member. The post form, you need a physician. It's documenting the physician and your conversation. So there's no lawyer in that process.
What is, Dr. Nesko, your concern when it comes to the aftermath of the incident in Bakersfield?
Well, I think that this, you know, it sounds like the woman in Bakersfield, she had an episode that her wishes were followed. But we don't really know. There's a lot of hype and concern that comes when a situation like this happens, and it's a good opportunity for us to raise these questions again. But I would really hope that we as a people can redirect our concerns, because we don't know all the issues that happened in Bakersfield. Let's let the folks in Bakersfield who are family members of that patient deal with those issues, and let's look at ourselves and our own lives and our own loved ones and what we can do to help prevent getting over-treatment for ourselves or under-treatment. Let's have these conversations with our loved ones and use this as an opportunity for all of us to get advance directives completed and post forms, if appropriate, completed for ourselves, or at least make sure that we're initiating these conversations.
Now, Dr. Myers, you mentioned, I mean, you are in Bakersfield. You mentioned you were at that facility that day. Being there and being in Bakersfield, do you think people have had the opportunity at this point to maybe step back and really look at this issue now that we've had a chance to learn more information?
We're certainly doing that. News media, of course, it's part of how news media do their job, is to focus on the dramatic and the immediate. The national news coverage of this story was unfortunately only focused on the dramatic and the immediate. That tape is so compelling, it would have been very hard for any organization to ignore. But fortunately, in the local circumstances, they have the ability to continue the conversation in exactly the way we're doing this morning. You might have seen that Dr. Black and I had a couple of op-ed pieces in Sunday's Bakersfield Californian, again, with the opportunity to step back and reflect a little bit. The general sense I'm hearing throughout town is it's great to hear that there's much more to this story than we may have initially thought. It's great as a reminder of how important it is for all of us to have these conversations. And I think really importantly, we have to reinforce that by all accounts, this facility, Glenwood Gardens, is among the best in Kern County, very highly valued by the residents and the family. If they have a problem with their policy, this blanket no intervention under any circumstance, I have no doubt that they will appropriately reconsider it, as I hope our facilities all across the country.
Thank you for that. And Dr. Nesko, do you think doctors will start kind of initiate a conversation now with their patients or residents?
Excellent question, Juanita. I can tell you, the physicians often don't have time in a visit in a clinic to deal with a long conversation, which this often develops into. Physicians will see a lot of patients through the day, and these conversations are difficult and have a bit of an emotional burden on the physician themselves. And we're people, and we have a tendency to avoid emotionally distressing conversations just like everybody else. So bottom line is, I wouldn't wait for your physician. Oftentimes the physician themselves is even wanting to perhaps go there or at least plant a seed, but they're hoping that you or your family will bring it up first, that you're wanting to have that conversation. So please, if you'd like to have that talk with your doctor, don't hesitate to bring it up first.
I think this has been a great opportunity to remind people it's not a topic a lot of people want to talk about, not a conversation. But now we're learning just how important it is to do that. And I would like to thank both of you for joining us this morning and then adding your comments to this. Dr. Michael Nesko, Program Director of the Hospice and Palliative Medicine Fellowship Program at UCF here in Fresno, and Dr. Christopher Myers, Director of the Kegley Institute of Ethics and a professor of philosophy at CSU Bakersfield. Thank you both for joining us this morning. We truly appreciate your time and your comments.
Thank you, Juanita.
Regarding
this. Thank you, Juanita.
Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.